Hello and welcome to Press X to Science, the podcast where Metroid meets Marie Curie. The topic for this episode is quantum computing using the citizen science game Quantum Moves. But before we get to that, let me introduce our regular co-hosts. First up is science educator and games-based learning advocate, Megan Pusey. Hey, Megan.
Hello.
And also joining us is astrophysicist and science communicator, Tim Young. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Tim.
If you want to learn more about our backgrounds, please listen to our first introductory episode, episode 000, and you'll hear about how we got our start in science and our passions about gaming. So this episode, we are talking about quantum computing. It can be a bit of a confusing subject, but we're going to make it a little bit less so for you all out there.
Unless, of course, you are Justin Trudeau, in which case yes, it's easy cakes.
That is true. He nailed it in one of his interviews. I'm sure he got prepped a little bit maybe by a resident scientist. But hey, we can always hope that our government is aware of science in that way. So today we are going to be talking about a really cool citizen science game called Quantum Moves. Now, it was made by a university, I guess, in conjunction with a game development company, but I haven't actually been able to find out who the game development company was. But the university is Aarhus University. You can go and play it right now. If you want to go and play it before you listen to the rest of this episode, you can go to scienceathome.com/games/quantum-moves. It's relatively easy to find if you just go to scienceathome.com as well. It's available on literally any platform you could possibly want it on. It's on Android, iOS, PC, Mac, and Linux. So there's really no excuse not to play this game.
I mean, it has to be on Linux, doesn't it?
You can't release a
quantum mechanics simulator game and not have it on Linux.
Correct. Yeah, no, I think that's right up the alley of Linux users everywhere, I'm certain. So you guys have had an opportunity to play this one in, I don't know, recent memory?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's good. So what did you think, like, as a overall, like, impressions of how polished the game is, that kind of stuff, before we get into the heavy science and explaining all that kind of stuff?
It has a crazy amount of polish. Like, it's surprisingly, for, I guess maybe my standards were set just really, really low.
Because citizen science games aren't always good games, because they're looking for really specific types of data and stuff, and sometimes that just doesn't lend itself well to being a fun game.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I thought I was relatively impressed. Like, the graphics are pretty good. The sound effects are present, which is something, which is something like the not always happens in citizen science games. And yeah, it seemed to present itself fairly well. If we can get into kind of I guess the motivation for even doing this citizen science, because citizen science it's not applicable to every discipline, and you may, I don't know. Personally, I think physics is probably one of the harder ones to kind of do citizen science with. So, if we can do a little bit of background into what a quantum computer is. Tim, do you have maybe a little primer for, qubits, atoms, quantum computers? Why is a quantum computer so great, I guess, is probably a really good way to start.
Well, I'm no Justin, but... the whole point of quantum computing is that a regular computer works through binary, through ones and zeros. Something is either on or it is off. And if you are making a computer chip, you make it out of atoms. And at the very smallest stage, so if you want to make your computer chip smaller and more powerful, you need to have more things in them that can be switched on or off. And eventually you get to a point where all you've got left are individual atoms, you know, and that one atom might be in its on state or its off state, whether that's a charged state or an elevated state, whatever it is. So at that point, you can't get any smaller, in which case your computer chips can't get any faster. And that's a big problem in the world of computing. It starts to come up against something called Moore's Law, which we're not going to cover in this episode, but is very interesting. So you should maybe have a bit of a read up on it for fun. If that's your sense of fun.
For homework.
So a quantum computer gets past this limitation by having a qubit or a qubit, depending on your preference, that can exist as an off, an on, or an off and on at the same time. So it has three different states rather than two. And this starts to exponentially increase the amount of computational power that you have at hand on the same size chip. So that's the really, really basics of it.
Yeah, but Tim, what is a qubit? Is it an atom, an electron? Like, what are we talking? So, because before you were saying atoms are the smallest we can go and they can be on or off. What is this and how is it different from just a regular atom?
That's a good question. And it's different depending on which sort of model of computer that you're looking to build. I mean, there's lots of different ways that you can sort of start to go into this way of doing things. But a lot of it at the moment revolves around supercooling atoms down to, you know, near absolute zero and then using lasers to position them in very careful and precise manners. But we don't actually have an actual feasible working quantum computer just yet. So I guess the answer is that we don't know.
Yeah.
We haven't been able to achieve it yet. So yeah, so you have these qubits, as Tim has explained. You can have them exist in ones, zeros, or kind of ones and zeros. And obviously that means that you can express way more different combinations of these zeros and ones in far less space, which means we get a lot more computing power. Now, at the moment, what we're, I guess, the bleeding edge of quantum computing is that we've got scientists and facilities around the world that are trying to trap these qubits in a way so that we can actually, like, you know, we can move them around and we can actually do things with qubits. At the moment, I think the largest bunch of qubits that have been able to be put into a nice regular space is around about 20 or 30, I think. And the way that they do this is, as Tim said, you cool down the atoms to around about negative 273 degrees, not negative 273 point whatever it is that is at zero Kelvin, but very, very close. And that's like a gas of atoms. And then what you do is that you actually you tune how these atoms are actually arranged by using a lattice of light. And you can kind of, the way that the guys explain it on the Citizen Science website, and you should really check it out because they're actually very good at explaining this kind of stuff. The way that they explain it is you can think of it as an egg carton, but rather than the egg carton being made of cardboard, it's made of light. And they're using lasers. So it's like a laser egg carton, which, if that doesn't sound
that's
really
very
awesome,
Tron.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you can think of it as a kind of a blue, awesome looking lattice. And yeah, so they basically trap the atoms in where you would put an egg, in an egg carton. And they've managed to do that with, between 20 and 30. They would like to get up to around about 300, I believe, is the kind of the ultimate aim. But yeah. The problem is that once they've gotten these atoms in the lattice, they're having a really hard time working out the best way of moving them around, because that is how you perform calculations in a computer, is you switch things on and off and you move things around, whether it's charge or the actual atoms in this case. So what the problem is that you need to be able to move the atoms around the, you know, egg carton of light fast enough that you avoid outside interference. Like, there is noise that is going on, like, all the time in the, you know, the quantum world. And also you want to keep the calculations efficient. You don't want it to take too long to move atoms around. Otherwise, you're kind of losing the point of having a really efficient computer that can do, that have these different states, these zero, one, and both kind of thing. So you want to move them around fast enough, but you can't move them around too fast, because then you'll lose the state of the atom, and you'll actually, it won't be a qubit anymore. It'll just be kind of a smear of nothing, essentially. It'll be like, those videos where you flip, they have all these magnets set around the table, and they flip one of them and they just all flip, kind of thing. So once you destabilize the lattice, it just goes into a mess. So yeah, the aim is to figure out exactly how to tune the laser that they're using to move these atoms around this lattice in a way that is both fast but also efficient, if that makes sense. Or fast but not too fast, but also efficient, so that you're not hitting this too fast or too slow. Like, there's a sweet spot. There's a Goldilocks zone in terms of this.
Yeah, and I liked how they represented that in the game. So in the game, you can't. There's no one solution to a level,
no.
But there's a leaderboard, and it shows you how high you are on the leaderboard, and you get points for being fast, but also retaining the most, I don't know what to call it, information, I guess, in your qubits. Like, yeah, you're moving one qubit, one divot of the egg carton, and you got, like, it's almost like water. I like thought of it as water sloshing around in there, in a, in the little divot. And the more water that you can keep in there and get it to the end zone that's sort of highlighted in a different color, and the quicker you can do it without it sloshing everywhere, the more points you get. And I think the highest I got was in the double digits for one level.
Good stuff. I think I only got triple digits once.
But that was like, I had to move it super quick, and sort of when you're ready to finish the level, you let go to sort of go, yep, that's my answer, that's my submission. And yeah, I had to go really, really quick to get the higher score. It was like ridiculously quick.
Yeah, it's really interesting how they've actually represented the problem, right? So as Megan has said, it's the I guess the stability of the atom and the information that it represents is in itself represented by what appears to be water. It's kind of doesn't act as water.
Like I think that when you get to the after the first few levels, you start to realize, actually, this is a bit weird. This is not acting how water would act because of the way quantum things work.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's a few levels where you have to use quantum tunneling. Which water doesn't do. So, you know, imagine you've got two of the egg divots next to each other, and you've got some liquid in one and the other one's empty. And so you hold the one with the liquid sort of next to the empty one, and it the liquid will transfer across through the wall.
Yeah. It's like putting two drinking glasses next to each other and having the liquid just suddenly go from one to the other without passing the intervening space.
So that was the mechanism you needed to use to solve some of the levels, and you kind of just figure it out by playing around. You don't need to understand quantum tunneling to be able to finish the level, but and you wouldn't even realize that's what you're doing. I think that's what I liked about the game. You don't need to understand quantum physics to be able to play and get really good scores, and you're still helping them with their data and figuring out the best way to do this.
Yeah, I mean the main reason why the scientists have, and why a lot of scientists turn to citizen science, is the fact that these kind of simulations, like in order to figure out the best way of moving these atoms, usually what they would use is computer simulations. And the way that we're definitely not going to get into how algorithms work for, you know, getting global minima and all that kind of stuff in computer simulations, because that's an entire episode by itself. But the problem with a lot of computer simulations, and the one that is kind of addressed by introducing humans, is that computer simulations aren't really that good at making leaps of logic or leaps of intuition. They kind of just brute force it. I mean, there are definitely modern algorithms that are doing a better job of this. So neural networks are one that you may have heard of. They're actually being built based off the human nervous system. And so they're kind of more interesting because they do tend to, in quotation marks, learn a lot quicker than traditional computer simulations. But the good thing about humans is that we don't need to know all this data about, quantum mechanics and all that kind of stuff. As Megan said, you can pretty much just play this as a complete ignorant person to physics, which is not a bad thing. Don't get me wrong. Like, ignorance is not stupidity or anything like that. But you can play this game and just focus on, okay, well, I know that if I move it in this particular way, then I get a better score than I do if I move it in this particular way. So I'm going to try that for a little while. And it's kind of that leap of intuition and knowledge that allows you to solve these questions way faster than a computer would be, because it's sitting there trying literally every single type of move. It doesn't skip any steps, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You actually end up being, as a human, way more efficient in finding novel solutions to a problem. Like in that one that Megan mentioned about the quantum tunneling, I didn't necessarily, you know, it's been a while since I've been at university, and you know, while I am semi-aware of quantum tunneling, I didn't immediately think, oh, I'll be able to use quantum tunneling to make this go faster. And I was probably in the same boat as a lot of people. I just played around with it, and then I was like, oh, okay, yeah, this is what this needs to be done.
So
like,
if I do this, this happens.
But exactly, even understanding that it was representing quantum tunneling, I was still having to play around to figure out the best way to get it to go the quickest. I found that level really hard, even though I did understand kind of what was going on. So yeah, it doesn't, I don't think it gives you much benefit.
No, no, I don't think so.
Because you have
either.
To be so quick as well to get the high score. So you can't just sort of sit there and think as you play to get the really good high scores. You got to play around with it for a bit and then try a few, go, oh, okay, that's my strategy, and then try it really, really fast. But then the water slide, well, you know, not the water, but the stuff starts sloshing everywhere over the top and you've lost it and it's gone. So it's this fine balance between speed and technique.
Yeah. And the other thing is that, I mean, I assume that we are going to start covering a lot of these sort of citizen science games in this podcast.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So one of the reasons that citizen science works so well in this particular case and doesn't work so well in other cases is that everybody will approach this in a very, very different manner. You know, they'll bring their own sort of way of thinking in. And by doing that, it gives you some constraints that simulations wouldn't necessarily be able to do very well. So, I mean, people also get very stuck in a rut thinking, oh, this is the best way to do it, and they will never try anything else. But sometimes that could also work in your advantage if you have enough people sort of thinking that way. It's like having lots and lots of very focused simulations running simultaneously. But you wouldn't expect a good citizen science project to be able to work like this on something that was more streamlined and more sort of obvious as the way that something goes, because a computer can do those things more quickly. So I think the other really good example of a citizen science project like this are things where pattern recognition and object recognition are very heavily in play. Things like Galaxy Zoo, where you're identifying the types of galaxies in a way that a computer just can't do.
I think there's another one called, I think it's Citizen Sort, where you're, from memory, classifying insects, like moths and things, and I think it was sharks, like actual photos or images of them. They're asking you to classify them according to certain features because I guess the algorithms can't really do it unless the moth or the shark is in a really specific like silhouette sort of almost
right.
Position. And so if it's not in that position exactly, the algorithm or the computer program has trouble with it, so they're asking people to help sort those images.
Yeah, it's in those spaces where computers and, you know, our ability to program algorithms that can do these things haven't quite caught up. I mean, there are, as like I said earlier, neural networks are kind of a really exciting, development, because they are actually coming close to being able to replicate how, you know, a human would learn to recognize silhouettes like that. Like I've seen a couple of videos where, you know, by using a neural network, a drone learnt to fly basically by just crashing into things. I think it crashed into 11,500 times it crashed, but then it could fly because it had recognized all the different ways in which objects can
which
approach
not
it.
To fly.
Yeah, essentially. And it wasn't necessarily just recognizing photos of where it's headed and going, oh, I recognize that that was a corner or anything like that. It was kind of recognizing how it approached it and all this kind of thing. So there are definitely spaces in which computers just cannot compete with humans. Obviously, pattern recognition is a huge one because we are so highly trained to recognize patterns in nature that we far outstrip the ability for computers to do the same thing. That's why you still have people watching security cameras and stuff like that. Obviously, face recognition is becoming a thing, but we're still far better at it. Like you'll know this from, you know, say if you're walking through a crowd looking for a friend, you'll be able to spot them in a crowd of thousands, you know, potentially.
Whereas your smartphone
very
can't.
Easily. Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, well, it'll recognize people.
Yeah, oh, lots of them.
Lots and lots of people, but not necessarily your friend. So another, I guess, side project for this particular citizen science initiative is Quantum Minds. So it's the same ish game. It's very similar anyway, but it actually, so I think this is very, very clever on the part of Aarhus University, is that they've got this quantum moves thing, and quantum mechanics and how the quantum world works is not straightforward, and I think that's putting it mildly.
it's like, take common sense, throw it out the window, and then that's quantum physics.
Exactly. Yeah. So these things aren't exactly intuitive, and especially, I mean, speaking for myself here, when I was trying to play through quantum moves, I mean, I think I got through around about 20 or 25 of the levels, but trying to understand how that liquid that wasn't quite liquid operated, it was definitely a learning experience.
Mm.
So it was really interesting that they've actually released another game which studies how people learn to get better scores in each level. So they actually are doing basically a meta game of Quantum Moves and studying how people's behaviors playing the game actually evolves in order to get higher scores, which I think is also really, really interesting, because that almost comes into kind of your guys' area of expertise, which is teaching people and outreach and seeing how people are actually engaging in this kind of stuff. I mean, have you guys ever done meta studies on people to see? I know, Megan, probably you definitely have, because you're...
That's what I'm interested in. Yeah, yeah. I'm just trying to design a study at the moment, but it is so ridiculously hard to measure learning, because any sort of experiment where a human is your subject is just, there's just so many ridiculous variables that you can't, it's really hard to say this caused this. But having a game as your tool makes it a little easier, because you can use all of the amazing amounts of data the game captures through them playing, like where they click or what they do in each attempt, how many times they failed before they succeeded, or, you know, how many times they attempted the level to get their high score. And, like, you can collect all that information automatically, so you know that that information is unbiased and that's just what it is. Whereas if you're relying on observation and interviews and things like that, that's a lot trickier, whereas I think this way of doing things is what I'm really into and is really, really interesting. And that learn, like, in games like this and other games are just built so you have to learn through failure in a way. So it's really interesting to watch how people learn, and it is how people learn, but the way that school sets it up is failure is really high stakes. You're almost discouraged from failing. So it's a really bad environment for learning in that sense, because if you're like, oh, I'm being judged on this, you sort of seize up and don't play around. That's how I feel
all the time.
Yeah, because we learn through play, and I guess, yeah, after early childhood education, the play is sort of drummed out of education, and it's all sort of assessment and, I don't know, yeah, it's not...
Gross stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I suppose that, like, I know this is maybe a long bow to draw, but I recently had a bit of an interesting, and Tim can probably relate to this because he's run about 1,000 D&D campaigns, but I recently tried out a new D&D system, which was called Dungeon World, and it actually encourages you to try and fail, and it kind of has a fail forward mechanic.
Yeah.
And yeah, it just encourages people to try out new things and not worry about, you know, rolling a critical fail or anything like that, because while you may fail, you fail forward. So good things still happen, or not good things, but things still happen. Interesting things. And it's far more interesting to play a game where interesting things happen even when you fail than it is to go, I'm going to try and knock down this door.
Yeah.
Oh, I rolled a 2. I didn't knock down that door.
Yeah.
Whereas in Dungeon World, it's, I want to knock down that door. I rolled a 2. I managed to knock down the door, but now there's a piece of wood stuck in my leg and I can only limp. I can only limp forward, and there's monsters closing in on me, and it's, you know, it's way more, it throws up more tense and interesting situations for players to make decisions in. So,
and I think good educators make an environment like that in their classroom, so that students do feel comfortable to fail forward. But when it comes to, like, formal assessment and stuff, it's sort of like, oh, I don't want to fail, so I don't want to fail. You know, I don't want to try and fail, so I'll just not try, or I'll only do the things I'm absolutely sure I know how to do. Whereas games like Quantum Moves, coming back to Quantum Moves, the scoreboard system, you get a score no matter what. And it might be a really bad score, but you can always try again and improve, and you can always repeat any of the levels, and there's no, you have to get to this certain score before you can move on. It's just do whatever you can, and great, thanks for adding to our research.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, how did you guys? I didn't actually get to the end of it. Did you? Did you guys?
I didn't reach the end either. No.
No, yeah. I think I got about halfway through. Sort of.
Yeah, it got really.
It got really hard. Yeah. I know I shouldn't give up when things get hard, but
No, give up. That's my number one policy in life.
But like, well, also it helps with their research. They know when people give up on these things. So,
I guess the sloshing behavior. It started to get really hard to just even get to the target area having any water left in your cup, because it would just sort of all slosh over the sides.
I found that as well, actually. Yeah.
And then it never came back. It just sort of stayed up at the top surface level of the divot instead of coming back into the divot like you would imagine water would.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's kind of where it differs from a regular game, right? In that usually a game would have maybe a tutorial for each level or something like that that shows kind of the beginnings of a solution, but that is absolutely not what you want in Citizen Science. You want to start from a blank slate.
Yeah.
And they give you enough to know how to play the game and what the goals are, what you should get to in each level. So you know, oh, that's the target area I've got to try and get the water to. But you know how to move around. They show you that, but they don't, like you said, they don't show you how to go about getting a solution, and they just give you tips like, oh, the faster you are, the more points you get, and things like that.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
But sorry?
It gives you tips where it's like, this is how to do it, we think. Maybe, sometimes. I mean, other times not so much. We're not really sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. But as like Tim and myself have made games before, and it would, I don't know about you, Tim, but it would frustrate the heck out of me if I couldn't give a player like pretty good guidance on how to play my game. Like imagine being one of the R-House guys and looking over the shoulder of someone playing this.
You're like, no, that's not how you meant to do it. Oh, wait, that worked really well.
Yeah.
But it's like in the classroom as well. I've run some lessons following this model. I don't know the official name, but it's like an inquiry model where you give the students like a prompt or something to play with, and you kind of have an idea of where you want to go, but you just sort of let them go at it and just ask them questions. You don't really give them answers or really give a much away, and just see what they discover for themselves. And most of the time it's not exactly, you know, textbook correct, but they sometimes some of them go off on these really interesting and weird tangents that you would never ever have thought of yourself. And I think for me that's the most interesting part. But I guess with games it's a little tricky because the game has to be designed in a way to allow for that to happen. Otherwise I think they just end up butting their heads against the wall.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So one thing that we haven't actually mentioned is the fact that this research actually got published in Nature, which is a pretty big deal. If you're not familiar with the scientific journal world, there's two really big ones. One's called Science and the other one's called Nature.
Very original.
Yeah, real inventive names there. But they are the two big ones, and it did actually the results from using quantum moves with all these players actually ended up in Nature, which is a pretty big deal. So they report here on their website that over 150,000 players had chalked up 8 million goes at the game, and they used, so the way that they actually use the info is to use it to program the laser. So they probably ran some kind of interpretation software, so they would have had to take the inputs from the players and convert that into what it would be for the laser to, you know, alter its intensity and position and all that kind of stuff. And they fed that into the laser, and I actually believe that they fed it into another computer simulation to kind of refine the edges off, because, you know, probably the fidelity of the player moving, you know, the little well.
Yeah, around. You have lots of like weird over steers and other bizarre behaviors,
and probably just not precise enough, right? So you're probably going to have to do some kind of interpolation to that data in order to actually get it to translate straight to a laser. And so they fed the player interaction into another computer simulation, which would have optimized it probably further, and then fed that, interpreted that into the laser that was moving the atoms around. And they actually found that they had solutions that were better than what they had come up with before. So it was faster, retained more information, retained more of the, you know, quantum state, which is insane. Like it obviously kind of goes to show that computers are good at some things, humans are also good at other things, and if you combine them in these unique ways, you can actually end up with a paper in Nature. So
and I think that, another similar one, which is pretty similar, but about folding proteins, is called Foldit. If you want to contribute to more scientific research,
or really just any of the fantastic games that are available at Science at Home.
Yeah.
There's actually stacks. Heaps. If you just go to scienceathome.org, actually, I think I said .com earlier, but it's .org. Actually, it's probably both.
It's probably both. I'd be very surprised if they haven't got both of the channels.
Yeah. They probably have done that. But if you go over there, you can contribute your game playing prowess to solving some pretty interesting problems.
Badass science.
Yeah, exactly. Obviously, we're gonna try and find as many of these citizen science games as possible to kind of review and give background to. But yeah, it's certainly a really, I don't know, I think it's a really, really interesting field, is how to actually design these games so that they are helping the scientists, not necessarily... Because it would be very easy not to design them properly. So there must be a bit of an art and a bit of a skill.
Yeah, and I think also for player engagement, because I've read a paper where they were looking at player contributions across 4 different citizen science games, and they found a lot of them would play a handful of times and then never again. So looking at motivation and why people were playing these games, and they found that people liked the idea of contributing to science, you know, for the good of science, but that wasn't enough to keep them playing after a handful of times.
Enough for us at research.
Yeah. So the game itself needed to be designed, well, I think going forward, like this one needs to be designed well as a game, as a standalone, you know, as a fun, engaging game to play. This is a trick, but also provide valuable data for the research. Moving forward, like the Citizen Sort one I mentioned earlier is pretty straightforward. It's not really a game as such, so they've had a high dropout from what I can tell, because in terms of people not coming back, and so they want as much data sorted, or as much data as they can generate, and so as many people playing as possible. So definitely something that I think we're moving into the right area with games like Quantum Moves and Fold It. They seem to be definitely heading in the right direction. So it'll be interesting to see more of these sorts of crossovers where you get the good game design and the good citizen science research sort of coming together.
Yeah. Well, we will be reviewing another game called Sea Hero Quest. That's in a later episode coming up, and that one actually does do a lot of these things right. So I guess with games like the sorted one, the sorting one, you could just put on a surface layer of achievements and, you know, currency to buy visual stuff, and that's what Sea Hero Quest does, and it's really interesting to talk about that one. So
I'm looking forward to that one. iWire is another one to check out. Has sort of achievements and leaderboards and things, because they realized that their gameplay wasn't particularly engaging, so they've purposefully added all those layers in to try and keep people playing.
All right. Well, thank you very much for listening. You can find us on the web at pressx2.science and on Facebook as facebook.com/pressx2science. We also have a Twitter, which is at pressx2science, predictively. We would really appreciate it if you could share the podcast through social media or word of mouth, because that's very effective. And if you feel like it, you can rate us up on iTunes with 5 stars if you enjoyed this episode. Also, feel free to send us any questions, comments, awesome science and video game stuff that you've seen. You can send that through to questions@pressx2.science. From the 3 of us here, we'll talk to you soon.